Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Michael Bloomberg and Tom Menino agree on guns and smoking. Days after New York City's outgoing mayor raises the purchase age to 21, our outgoing mayor is poised to ban smoking in parks. We'll get your take. Then, unless you're in a tent outside some big box store, it's food, family, and TV tomorrow. A TV critic makes recommendations. And the Globe's editor joins us to talk shop and about politicians going into the marijuana dispensary business.
Mass Lawyers Weekly, David Frank on yet another United States Supreme Court Obamacare challenge. And will Yohar Tsarnaev get the death penalty? Then we've talked about Thanksgiving TV. We've talked about Thanksgiving food. All that's left is Thanksgiving wine. Jonathan Alsop joins us to give us his suggestions. That's all coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hey.
So the city is going to make lighting up that much harder for smokers. The Boston City Council has unanimously passed an ordinance to ban smoking in parks, cemeteries, public squares. In fact, any open space that's run by Parks and Recreation. But I guess here's some good news for smokers. The Department of Parks and Recreation does not oversee parklets. You know, those little tiny things.
Yeah, that's it.
The Boston Transportation Department
Oasis.
Does. Well, that's true. So maybe these parklets will now get some use. Anyhow, joining us on the line to explain how the city will enforce this and where it came from is Boston City Councilor. He's the guy whose committee held hearings on this measure. That would be Councilor Matt O'Malley. Councilor, good to talk to you.
Great to be with you, Jim and Marjorie.
How are you, Councilor O'Malley?
I have to admit, great, thanks.
I have to admit I'm a little hostile to your proposal. Do you ever smoke, Matt O'Malley?
I did. I was a smoker for many years in college and after college, and still have to lean on the occasional piece of Nicorette
okay.
to get to council meetings. So I know it's a habit that is very difficult to kick, but I know that most smokers and former smokers like myself would rather be ex-smokers.
But don't you feel a little empathy? I mean, when you're talking about the people on Boston Common, a lot of them, as you know, they're not just people sneaking over from Tufts because they can't smoke there or from the restaurants.
Well, some are, actually.
Some are, but a lot of them are people that are, let's put it this way, down on their luck. You know what I'm saying, Matt? They're there, and they're down on their luck, and they're smoking cigarettes because this is about all they got going for them. What are they going to do?
Well, first of all, this does not outlaw smoking or ban smoking. You can still smoke on sidewalks, as parkless, as you said, other areas in your home, in your backyard. But what Boston is doing, and you know, this was a proposal by Mayor Menino, one that I was proud to support, one that I think makes sense, and quite frankly, I think is long overdue, is to look at these shared areas, these playgrounds, these parks, these open areas where we really want people to congregate. Boston Common, the Public Garden are great examples both. And we want to make sure that people are able to enjoy our parks and not suffer any ill health consequences. So, you know, obviously secondhand smoke is more impactful in enclosed spaces and bars and restaurants. One of the reasons why the mayor, I think, correctly banned smoking in restaurants and bars about 10 or 12 years ago. But studies have shown that even outside, secondhand smoke can have a profound impact on one's health. And according to the Department of Health and Human Services, in order you need to be 25 feet away from someone smoking to not be within the zone or perhaps suffer some of the ill effects of secondhand smoke. So that's the first piece of this legislation, is we want to make sure that everyone's health is taken into account. The second part is the fact that cigarette butts are the number one littered item across the country. We see them everywhere. It's a
Amen.
Mine. People do not throw them out. There was one statistic that I saw that said that cigarette butts, Americans discard more than 175 million pounds of cigarette butts every year. I mean, you think how small they are, just how astronomical that number can be. This is going to get those butts out of the parks. And the third, it will encourage smokers to smoke less. And, you know, as I referenced a little bit earlier, in 2000, the number of Bostonians who identified themselves as smokers was just under 25%. Now that number is plummeted to 16%. We still have ways to go, but in terms of cities, we're one of the more healthful cities. We have less smokers. And I think a large part of that was the fact that the mayor correctly banned smoking from parks and restaurants. It changed people's behavior. You know, as an ex-smoker, it certainly, you know, affected me. and led me to becoming an ex-smoker. So I think that these are three items why this legislation makes sense.
Hey, Madam Mel, just a couple of quick things. If I were a city councilor in Boston, even though I know it was unanimous, I probably would have amended your proposal to say that if people, after they smoke a cigarette in the common, for example, were willing to eat the butt, then they could smoke there. But I know that amendment was not filed, so we'll forget that. So, but I want to anticipate something. When we hang up on you, Councillor O'Malley, Marjorie and I are going to talk to listeners, and Marjorie will do what she always does, which is say, Jim, the reason you support what Councillor O'Malley and his colleagues did is because your real agenda, meaning mine, is to ban smoking everywhere, including in private residences. So I can speak for myself.
It already is.
What's your agenda? Does it go farther than this, or sidewalks next? What's next in the anti-smoking agenda?
My agenda is, in all honesty, I want to see us offer more programs in the city, particularly for lower-income people.
Good.
Stop smoking, the smoking cessation programs, the patch, Nicorette, or nicotine gum. I probably shouldn't give any companies plugs.
It's fine.
So I think there's a lot of opportunities that I would really like to see the city. And I know through our Public Health Commission and Barbara Ferrer, we've done some great things, but I want to see that stepped up. I want every smoker who wants to become an ex-smoker to be able to have help from City Hall, just getting information, getting support, getting discounts on products, because it can be very expensive. Not as expensive as smoking, but nonetheless, it can be an expensive undertaking. So that's really what I want to see us next. This legislation was really about getting people to use our parks more. We have a fantastic park system in the city of Boston, one thing that I've been proud to champion in my 3 years on the council. So I want to make sure that our parks are welcoming and healthy places for kids and for people of all ages to take advantage of. I'm not looking to take this any farther in terms of sidewalks or people's, privacy of their own houses.
They are banned in public housing, right?
Well, in public housing, they are banned for the same reason. But if that is correct, and that's something that I also think makes sense, and that's gone into effect the last couple of years, and I represent a district that has about a quarter of its population of senior citizens. So I, at least once a month, I'm hosting a pizza party in some senior building, and residents are very thankful for that because they can interact more. Many of them have had respiratory problems, and this addresses that. But, I'm not looking to ban smoking outright or to prevent people from doing, what they are legally entitled to do. I just want to make sure in our shared places, our parks, our playgrounds, that people are able to use it and enjoy it without having to deal with secondhand smoke.
Well, I'll try to change your mind on the banning thing someday in the future. Hey, Matt O'Malley, before you go away, I should know the answer to this question, but quickly, where is the incoming mayor on these kinds of things? Do you have any idea?
I don't know, and I was with him at an event the other night. This didn't come up.
Yeah.
This particular legislation was authored by Mayor Menino, came to the council. We had a hearing. We voted on it. If he hasn't signed it already, he will, since he's the
We read that.
Yeah, we'll go into effect. I'm not sure where Mayor-elect Walsh is, but I know he's a guy who, cares deeply and loves our parks as well. So.
Good. Hey, Councillor O'Malley, thanks so much for your time and congratulations on the vote. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you guys.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Same to you, too, Matt.
I hope things go well with the Nicorette gum, Matt.
Absolutely. Thanks,
Marjorie. See you later.
With the Nicorette gum. So non-smokers, are you with City Councilor O'Malley and me? And smokers, is this the kind of enforcement you need to curb your smoking? Or do you feel like the city is kicking you to the curb, literally, leaving city sidewalks and our two parklets is the only place where you can legally light up? Obviously, you can do it in your house if you have a single-family dwelling. To our numbers, 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. I mentioned at the top of the show, we have two mayors, prominent mayors, leaving office who've done great things. They've led the national charge for gun control, not terribly successful so far. That, of course, is Medford's own Michael Bloomberg.
Correct.
And Tom Menino. Michael Bloomberg last week signed a measure that raised the purchase age. You can't purchase cigarettes in New York City anymore, including e-cigarettes, everything, until you're 21, a terrific step in the right direction in terms of youth smoking. And now Tom Menino is about to sign or has signed or will sign, just say no to parks and those other public places because he actually cares about secondhand smoke and those kind of things. So what do you think about that, Marjorie?
Well, I think, number one, that we ridiculed the parklets last week for the fact that no one is sitting in them. Now they'll be rushing to the parklets because that'll be the only place that they can smoke outside in Boston. Number two, we neglected to point out it's going to be a $250 fine. Yeah. The first time you light up on Boston Common, that is a lot of money. I mean, you'd be going 110 miles an hour in the Mass Pike. What's the fine in the Mass for
going
that
never
fast?
Gotten stopped for speeding, you know, so
that's
I wouldn't
right.
know.
Well, Jim is the only person in America that's under 80 who drives at 55 miles an hour in the Massachusetts Turnpike. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see what Marty Walsh thinks about this as a recovering alcoholic who has probably a lot of empathy for people that are dealing with one addiction by going to another.
Yeah,
if you ever go
true.
To AA meeting or stand outside an AA meeting, what do you
outside,
see?
Yeah.
You see people with their Dunkin' Donuts cups smoking like a furnace. Jack just emailed. I'm with Jack on this.
Thank you,
Jack. Leave people alone.
Well, let me explain. There's one point you raised that was actually a very good one, Marjorie. The fine is $250. The maximum fine is $250. They're not going to fine it by $250. But let's assume they do. There's a very creative way, and this comes from my legal training. Do you know how you avoid the $250 fine?
You don't smoke in Boston Common.
Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, even though Marjorie will assert that this is my position, I'm not for an outright ban. But for people
Marjorie, who contends...
You
want people not to be able to smoke in the condominiums they own if they're in multi-building, if they're in multi-apartment.
That's correct.
So you would ban smoking in private homes.
Private homes if it turns out you're in a multi-family building.
Home. It's a private home, Jim.
Marjorie, every time we have this discussion, then we'll get to your calls in a second. I ask you the same question, which I'll be happy to ask you now.
For your condo.
When's the last time
smoking.
When's the last time you stayed in a hotel that had smoking areas?
Never.
Excuse me. You said last time you had.
Smoking areas?
Yeah, no. Some rooms you're allowed smoking. In certain states you're allowed
I never stay in a smoking room.
I know you don't, but I'm saying. Well,
I did stay in a couple of seedy hotels last year on a story that actually I had to drive home 7 hours rather than stay in the seedy
hotel. Well, let me say two things. One.
You check for the bed bugs. You know how you do that? You pick up the sheets.
I know what you do.
In the corners.
I think it's better not to check. Okay, here's what you've said in the past, which you've obviously conveniently forgot.
What's that?
One, in a hotel that is now non-smoking, which used to be allow smoking, even if they banned it years before, you still smell it, no matter what. Number two, this is the other point you made that you've acknowledged that you're choosing not to acknowledge today. And this deals with secondhand smoke in places like Park, etc. If people are smoking behind a locked door in their apartment or hotel room, and you walk
smoke
by that room,
out.
Do you not smell it and then smell it on your clothes? The point
yes,
being, secondhand smoke is
real. I
don't
think walking by a hotel room is going to cause you adverse health effects, even if you do have to smell the smoke for the nanosecond that you
How about this, to me, you know what this is, Jim? You think these public health people are lying, Marjorie?
No. Smoking is terrible. Everybody knows, except for obesity. It's the biggest health underminer there is. And
it's pretty close to number one.
It's absolutely awful. But it's just... You know, you're like a leper now. You're like a pedophile. You're like the worst person in the world if you smoke. It's this wagging of the finger. No more smoking. No more smoking. And it's just the holy of the
matter. What was your position when Tominino took the lead maybe a decade ago, just like Matt O'Malley said, and banned smoking in restaurants? The concern then was the workers.
Business.
My assumption is you were against that. Does that say we don't tell us where to smoke and what? Let's have smoking areas?
I was for smoking sections.
How happy are you that there are no smoking sections at all in restaurants?
I'm happy. But I can't transfer the hotel rooms and the restaurants to the Boston Common, which is a big open space. Matt O'Malley said that the medicine says you have to be 25 feet away, and I'm sure that's correct.
You ever walk by a building where the employees in the dead of winter have gone outside to smoke, and you tell me that when you walk by them, horrible.
Do you know what's an interesting thing? And I'd like to see what you have to say about this.
Go ahead.
If you were ever at a crowded meeting or a movie theater or someplace where people are, or the subway where people are very close together, and someone comes in and sits down next to you or stands next to you, who just smoked.
I know.
They smell awful.
Exactly, my point.
Want to ban them?
What, the people?
That you have to smell their smoke-infested clothes? Or
no,
smoke.
But I don't want to ban them. But the point, Marjorie, that you're
you
making
do,
my
you
point,
make everybody
which is...
get in a hazmat suit if they're going to have a cigarette. That's what people used to do that was trying to fool their boyfriends or girlfriends that they smoked. Girls would do this mostly because boys have shorter hair.
Do what?
Wrap their hair in a towel.
Really?
So they couldn't smell the smoke on their hair.
So the bottom line is, if people want to kill themselves, which is what they're doing, and they could do it in a way that doesn't cause people who choose not to kill themselves to be infected by it, I would have a more open mind than I do. But in light of the fact that secondhand smoke is real, by the way, you know who was one of the most C. Everett Koop was the guy who, I guess, was he the first one who started this secondhand smoke thing? Former Surgeon General, whether he was or not, do you know he was one of the most outspoken Surgeon Generals on this issue, George W. Bush's, was a huge anti-secondhand smoke person. The point is, it's not a partisan issue. Most thinking people realize it's time to say no. And good for Tominino and the unanimous city council that voted to get rid of this
thing. Count me among the non-thinking people.
Well, I didn't mean to say you were non-thinking, actually.
Yes, you did.
Maybe I did. 877-301-8970. Can't smoke, assuming that the mayor signs this, which he says he will.
Yeah.
You can't smoke in Boston Common.
What's going to happen soon is you're not going to be
able to smoke. Parks
in
Boston.
Anywhere. You're not going to be able to smoke anywhere. And it really bothers me that people, especially old people, it really bothers me that people who are 85 years old, who smoke since they're 13, who are living in public housing projects, have to go outside in February.
What did Matt O'Malley just say? That he has a quarter of his district, his city council district, are senior citizens.
Because most people don't
smoke. And every
smoke.
Time he goes to one of these places, they thank him for leading the
That's
charge
the majority.
Here.
The rights of the minority also count, Jim. Those people who are addicted to cigarettes and would like to quit because it's very hard to quit smoking. Mm,
this is going to help them.
Plus, they can't afford to get a lot of the programs and the accoutrements that enable them to quit smoking.
Well, that's a very good point. And O'Malley made a very good point. If we're going to make smoking much more difficult, if government is going to make smoking much more difficult, then they have an obligation that goes with it to provide programs, just like he suggested. So I'm with you on that. 877-301-8970. Which side are you on? And by the way, Boston is not alone here. Apparently, there are hundreds of cities across the country that have done what Boston is about to do.
Liz in the car. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Marjorie. You're going to be mad at me, but I'm a severe asthmatic, and I'm actually very happy about this because, unfortunately, I can't go to a lot of public places without needing my inhaler because of people that smoke, and I can't choose to not have an asthma attack, and it's really debilitating when that happens.
Well, I'm not mad at you, Liz. I mean, it's terrible to have asthma, and I'm sympathetic to you to the situation, absolutely. Like I said, I just don't like the fact that people in outdoor areas or people
Should
in their
Liz
own
not
homes.
Walk through Boston
yeah,
Common?
Unfortunately, it still affects me, even when it's in an open area, and people think that it doesn't, but it still triggers, you know, people who have breathing problems, it still triggers an episode for them.
Liz, why don't you say to Marjorie, should I not walk through Boston Common? See what she says to that. I'll ask her for you. Should Liz not walk through Boston Common?
Absolutely be able to walk through
and
Boston
now she can.
Common. Now
Liz,
she
thanks
can.
For your call. She's not mad at you.
I'm not mad at you.
She's enraged.
I'm enraged.
She's not. Liz, thank you for the call. I mean, isn't Liz sort of, it almost ends the discussion. What more is there to say? This is a woman who suffers as a result of this thing. She's not an outlier. Asthma is a real serious mm-hmm. problem. And she says that smoking, even as she said, in public places is a problem. End of discussion. Whose rights are more important? She didn't choose to smoke. Someone else chose to smoke
yes,
and she
again,
suffers.
Again, I know secondhand smoke is a big problem. And if you're working as a waitress or a waiter in a place or a bar room where there was smoking, you were breathing it in all night. Terrible problem. If you're sitting in an apartment with parents that smoke like a furnace, or like most of us when we were kids, in a car with parents that smoke like a furnace, it's a big problem. I just am a little bit more skeptical because we'd all be dead by now.
What do you say to Liz? Liz just said she can't go through
public
places.
I think she's
places.
Got a very serious health problem, and that's true. But that's kind of like saying people that no one should wear perfume because there are some people that are allergic to perfume.
There are a huge number of asthmatic. People have
right.
asthma
and
in
there
cities.
Are a lot of people that are allergic to a lot of
Can I get
smell
this
things.
If they want to ban cologne, I'm there too. I mean, I am serious. People who bathe themselves in cologne, that's for another day. Let's go to Roxbury where Michael is on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Michael, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Jim and Marjorie. I hope you guys are having a good day.
We are so far, yeah.
It's kind
Thanks.
Of a lousy day. There wasn't. Well, look at that outside. You know, it's horrible.
Well, you know, everybody should be concerned because the CDC has just determined that the air quality in most major cities in the United States is actually equal in filth to passive cigarette smoke. So I think that, you know, I feel terrible for someone who's asthmatic and they walk by a smoker and it triggers an asthma attack. But I think for absolutely the vast majority of people walking through a park, they are completely physically unaffected by it. There are absolutely no scientific studies that I have ever seen, and I actually look for these because I am a smoker, that say if you walk through a park and someone's smoking, this is a threat to your life. I think that a lot of this is about annoyance. And like I said, I feel terrible for this person who's an asthmatic. You know, it's terrible. But if you're an asthmatic, why wouldn't you be far more concerned with the fact that the air quality in our city is so bad?
Well, but Michael, I got to cut you off.
Hold on.
They're not mutually
Michael
exclusive.
Michael raises a great point. It's easier
what,
to
What, Liz isn't worried about that?
It's easier to crack down on poor people. It's poor people. There's a big class distinction.
I'm
who
not
smokes.
Poor, by the way.
Well, I didn't say you were poor, Michael, but when you look at who smokes, I mean,
it's mostly poor people.
So it's really easy to crack down on poor people. It's really easy to crack down on people who live in housing projects, who would rather not live in housing projects, but they can't afford to live anyplace else. It's much harder to cut down the big polluters.
Excuse me. Barack Obama, who is being criticized deeply because of his healthcare.gov, has dealt with emission standards in a real serious way to the point where the auto industry is ready to strangle him.
We're better.
Well, I understand we're better. But the point is, Michael, you can walk and chew – I don't mean you. One can walk and chew gum at the same time, deal with industries that are spitting out things that are bad for us, and people who are smoking as well. Michael, thanks for your thoughts.
We were just talking about climate change last week with someone. I forget who we were talking about. And he made the point that one of the issues is not just in the inner cities is pollution. And who lives in the inner cities? People that are in large
parts. But what is the point? So, since we're not dealing with industrial pollution competently enough, then we should ignore smoking?
It's just easier to do this. I guess there's something in me that says, oh, everybody that's living over in Wellesley and Weston is cracking down on the people that live in the D Street Project in South Boston.
Well, that's actually an equitable kind of thing, but so let them go smoke in Weston. Maybe that'll even things out.
Let them go smoke in Weston. It'd be a lot harder if it were different. If it were all the CEOs and all the techies and all these people that were or all the media tycoons that were heavy smokers.
Can I ask you something? These poor people, who you have empathy for here, because it is true.
Especially old ones.
Okay, you have empathy for. Will they live healthier lives
if
these things go into place?
Of course.
So it's a win-win proposition. The only downside of this, other than those who believe government should never be involved in these things, which is not. I don't think your position. The only downside is there's some inconvenience for people who want to smoke a cigarette. I'm willing to live for the inconvenience. The secondhand smoke disappears to a degree, and the primary recipient of the smoker, him or herself, benefits. So what's the downside?
What we need here is we need someone who's in recovery to tell us about the addictive personality, that you go from your addiction to liquor to your addiction to cigarettes or your addiction
Marjorie,
to
I was smoking three packs a day until a couple of years ago.
You've never smoked in your whole life.
I had one cigarette.
Which is another thing that's annoying about this conversation. Here you are over there.
I
have no idea
how hard
it is to quit
smoking. I had a Tarryton many years ago.
A Tarryton. Was it a Tarryton 100, Jim?
I don't remember. I think it was before 100. Let's go to Robert.
Was it a Virginia Slim, was it?
Let's go to Robert in Boston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. How are you guys?
We're
fine,
excellent.
Thank you.
Good. What's getting me about the smoking transition that's been here in Boston, and I've been here now close to 15 years, is my choice to smoke in a cigar bar. And I know it's awful. The smell is more intense. But as a choice, they really stopped giving out licenses and permits to these establishments. And it's our choice to walk in there and have maybe one cigar a month with friends and so forth, and we're losing this benefit.
Robert, I don't remember. I'm embarrassed because a good friend of both of ours, Joe Legati, who I
went to
the North End, the guy from Boston, he took me to a cigar bar, and I have to say I had a really good time that one night. My recollection is, are they phasing out the rights of these cigar bars in the city to exist? I can't remember what the law is. Do you?
Newest license that was issued was in Charlestown, which was Tangerino's, which is a hookah bar that sells cigars.
Uh-huh. So what do they have, like 10 years or 20 years? What's the deal? I just can't remember.
I think they're close to 10 years now at this point.
Okay.
But the Millennium Hotel in Boston, that license got lost. They didn't renew it, so that place is gone. They basically have Tangerino's. You have Cigar Masters on Boylston. And then you also have the place at the North End.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the place, but I am very critical of smoking and smokers, and I have to say it was a fun evening. Hey, Robert, thank you for the call. We're going to check that out because I'm not sure what the answer is.
This would also, of course, ban pipe smoking, and it's funny how because pipe smoking often
smells better.
People aren't as bothered by it because for whatever reason it doesn't have that awful cigarette smoke smell.
You know, the issue beyond secondhand smoke, there's also, I know you're an anti-litter person, big time. You heard what Matt O'Malley, the city councilor, said about litter. What did he say?
I think it's disgusting that people don't throw out their
cigarettes. But they don't.
And I know, so the reality,
and so if it turns, you don't think that the threat of getting a $250 fine, I know that you're not crazy about it, and $250 is a lot of money. I agree. It may be a bit excessive, but you don't think that's going to scare people out of doing this? I think it is. We're going to read in the Herald, there's going to be a front page story of a guy with his pockets empty because he had to pay the $250 fine. And as soon as people see that they're serious about this, people are going to stop smoking in these places. Well, By the way, our colleagues, our producers said, yes, existing licenses now, and if you have one, you can still be open, but they're not issuing any new cigar license. The only other question is, do the people with existing licenses, at some point, do they get phased out too? We'll find that in a minute.
You know what's going to happen?
What's that?
If they do start enforcing this and people don't smoke in Boston Common or other parks, they're just going to smoke on the sidewalks outside the parks. So you'll have the same thing going on with people having to walk through a cloud of smoke. And by the way, I have never seen anybody smoking in a playground. Never, ever, ever.
I don't know.
Are you kidding? The mothers are over there in 2 seconds.
But so then it's not a problem to formally ban it, which this would do, right? Does this not cover that as well?
If
anybody thought about doing it, they're going to have to pay a fine potentially. Let's go to Belmont where Cindy's on the phone. Cindy, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hi.
Yeah,
I'm allergic to cigarette smoke, and honestly, I wish they'd ban it on the sidewalks as well. But controversial enough, just with the parks. I am calling to say that I have a holistic program on my website, and it has a 92% success rate for people quitting. You mentioned that most people who smoke really don't want to be smokers.
That's what they say.
And at wisdomofhealing.com, wisdom of healing is all one word.
We got it.
There's a great way to quit, and it's all natural.
Thank you.
Well, people will check that out and make a decision. Cindy, thank you for your call. Let's go to the hometown of Marjorie Egan, the original hometown of Marjorie Egan. That'd be Fall River, where Robert is on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Robert.
Hi, Robert.
Hey, guys. How are you doing today?
Excellent. Great. Good.
Hi. First of all, I am a medical professional. I work at an addiction recovery facility where smoking is not allowed on the grounds whatsoever. I just was hired there, so a few months ago when I went and got hired, I had to take a carbon test to make sure that I was not, in fact, a smoker.
Wow.
Because they do not allow it, not only on the facility, but any of the new employees coming in to be smokers. They grandfathered in previous employees who were already smokers to stay at the facility working, but they take it very seriously. This being said, I have worked in Boston before, and I understand the fact that a lot of facilities, I believe it may be state law that says you cannot smoke within 20 to 25 feet of an entrance to any public place.
Right.
I think that's right, yeah.
And nobody follows this. I would have infinitely more sympathy for any smoker if I didn't see smokers smoking right at the door and forcing me to walk through their cloud of disgusting cigarette smoke when I walked into the store. That being said, when you ask them, please, you know, do you mind respecting that law and respecting my health, they get nasty with you. And it's not every smoker. I don't want to generalize the entire group of the smoking population of the, you know, Boston or United States. But more often than not, if you ask someone to, you know, respect your health and not smoke where they're not supposed to, they almost always get defensive and
hey, Robert,
not, in fact, listen to you. Go
Robert,
ahead.
Let me ask you a question. As someone who works in recovery, why is it that when you see people, you know, outside churches and stuff, waiting to go into an AA meeting or wherever they're having the AA meeting, you see, it almost seems to me that people are replacing their addiction to the alcohol with the addiction to the cigarettes. You see so many people out there smoking. Matter of fact, down the Cape, they used to list in the Cape Cod Times.
Yeah. I know what you're saying because there's a sliding scale of addiction.
Right.
And I can't use too many specifics, but obviously some drugs are worse than others. And while alcohol has an immediate negative detrimental effect to the user and their performance in their doing their everyday lives, smoking does not have that effect.
Right.
So, it's kind of one of those blue laws that, you know, doesn't really get enforced very much.
Okay.
I did want to say one more thing.
Quickly.
And, Jim, you might want to watch Marjorie's eyes for them to roll.
I'm watching. Go ahead.
I don't know if you've heard anything, but there's been doing a lot of studies recently with third-hand smoke, which, in fact, is the smell of cigarette smoke in your hair, on your clothes, in your breath. And the studies are showing that third-hand smoke is just as carcinogenic as second-hand smoke, and it's deadly to everybody.
She's rolling her eyes. Robert, I want you to know I wasn't going to tell Marjorie. That's what I got her for Christmas, one of those studies. I'm going to wrap it and give it to her. Robert,
thank you for the call.
Now, before we wrap this up,
yes,
Marjorie,
Jim.
How many people, I know this is a random sampling, how many people were with me? And how many people were with you so far?
I had one emailer, Jack.
One emailer.
Thank you for emailing, Jack.
He's emailing from the sidewalk.
That's
outside
right.
Tufts Medical Center.
That's right. I would say I was fairly swamped in that one. But nonetheless.
You know, Tom Menino is in studio with us Monday at noon, Marjorie. Why don't you get into this with the outgoing mayor?
We'll get into this with the outgoing mayor.
I think you
mayor.
Should do that. That's a great idea.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to talk to Boston Globe editor Brian McGrow. We'll get his take on the smoking ban as well and a bunch of other things. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This Thanksgiving, while the turkey roasts and the veggies sauté, we've got some great conversation to add into what's cooking in your kitchen. From noon to 5, turn on back-to-back episodes of Here's the Thing. Alec Baldwin talks with all kinds of creative types, writers, film directors, athletes, about how they got to where they are. That's Thursday and Friday afternoons this week from noon to 5 here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And nature. This triple feature evening features films highlighting the turkey, the duck, and the deer, sandwiched together like a Thanksgiving turducken. It's a full evening of nature, Wednesday starting at 8 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Thanksgiving not only comes with its culinary traditions, it also has its television rituals. Football, the Macy's Day Parade, and relative newcomer, the National Dog Show. So even though we're in the golden age of television, why are so many people tuning into these network TV standbys, or are we? Joining us to go over Thanksgiving Day TV, and that, of course, is only for those not already intense waiting for Black Friday, and other industry news is Bob Thompson. Bob is the founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communication at Syracuse University. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Bob. Thank you for joining us. So before we get to how many people are watching football on Macy's, I'm dying to find out, because I'm a big fan of this myself, about people watching the National Dog Show.
Well, we don't know yet how many are going to watch it this year, but if we go by last year's coverage, and of course this comes right, it's got the lead-in of the parade, last year's coverage of the National Dog Show presented by Purina, which was its fullest, full name, was up 13% in its ratings to a 5.3, which for a Thursday daytime show is not a bad rating.
Okay, so for those of us who have missed this, and that includes both me and Marjorie, here are the finalists in the National Dog Show from 2012. John O'Hurley and David Fry host the show. Listen.
2,000 dogs came through this arena today. It's been whittled down to 7, the winners of each group. David, take us down that line. The Dalmatian first.
The Dalmatian from the non-sporting group. The Bernese from the working group. The Australian Shepherd from the herding group. The English Springer Spaniel from the sporting group. The Whippet from the hound group. The Wire Fox Terrier. And from the toy group, last but certainly not least, the Affenpinscher.
I am so there, Bob. I cannot see straight. You know, we didn't
know. I can't believe you just played that without a spoiler alert.
You know, not only did neither Marjorie nor I ever heard of this, what makes it even stranger is in my top three movies of all time, and I think Marjorie's too, is Best in Show, one of the funniest movies. And apparently that in part was inspired by the National Dog Show.
That's what I've heard. And not only is this show becoming a big deal, but last year 5.3 rating overall, but its ratings among 18 to 49-year-olds, you know, the hard-to-get but got-to-have demographic, it jumped 24% from the previous year. So I don't know what that's all about, but this is not only doing well overall, it's doing well among hip young people.
But it's a riot. You know what's so funny? The handlers. You see the handlers come out, and there's always some woman, you know, middle-aged woman who's got her suit on, and she maybe has got 5 or 10 pounds to lose.
How do you know this? You've never seen the show.
Because I've watched clips of it. I haven't seen the whole thing. But I've watched clips of it on TV, and she's jogging around with her Norwich Terrier or her Dalmatian or her Whippet, whatever it is, and it's just so funny. Everybody's so serious, and the dogs are like, you know, cutting up. I mean, it's just a riot, and I love that movie. Pond, remember that?
Academia.
Yeah.
So, Bob, you don't sound enthusiastic about the show, though. Is that a fair statement?
Well, here's my theory. I'm going on last year's numbers because we don't have them yet for this year because it hasn't happened yet. But last year on NBC, The Parade got a 12.1 rating. Now, that isn't to say I think people are watching The Parade. I think what happens is pretty much what happens in my house and has for a long time is that you get up, you turn on The Parade because it's what you do. It's like hanging up stocking or lighting a menorah. It's what you do for those holidays. And then you're off and answering the door as relatives are coming in, stuffing the turkey, whatever. And it's become kind of the background noise to the rating of 12.1. The dog show last year got a 5.3, and I am pretty convinced the reason that dog show does as well as it does is that the TV's on, the parade ends at noon, and half the people who had the parade on are too busy out in the kitchen to turn it off.
So that's an indirect way of saying it would not be appointment viewing in the Thompson household. Is that a safe assumption?
I think not only that, but I would speculate it probably wouldn't be in appointment viewing across the board. And part of it is you point out, and there is nothing like somebody who looks kind of like a whippet jogging around with a whippet connected to a
exactly,
week.
Exactly.
But
or a bulldog and a bulldog.
Right. And I imagine a lot of people are watching this with a bit of tongue-in-cheek and elbow and rib, but it doesn't have that. There's a lot of programs we watch to mock the Real Housewives series. Mm-hmm. Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. This is a hard show to sit all the way through in that complete state of mockery because the thing is done in such earnest. And I have to say, when I do end up watching for 10 or 15 minutes at a time, by the end of that 15 minutes, I've slowly but surely and grudgingly kind of gotten into it.
You know, the only thing funnier than Best in Show, and I hope you've seen this, have you ever seen Triumph the Comic Insult Dog go to the Westminster Dog Show? One of the funniest things ever. Now, what Bob Thompson tried to do, and I picked up on it, mm-hmm. he thought that if he slid into the Macy's Day Parade as an afterthought with the National Dog Show, we wouldn't have to talk about it, but we will. Here is some sound from last year's Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade, Bob. Al Roker and Savannah Guthrie, you know, from the Today Show, provide, I guess, what you could call a cringeworthy introduction for the Kool-Aid float. Here it is.
Check out this picture-perfect picture. It's Kool-Aid Man, provided to us by Kraft Foods. Drinking in the sights during his third visit to the Macy's Parade, our super cool skateboarding pitcher has some very cool news to report.
That's right. Kool-Aid is launching two new delicious and exciting flavors next year, watermelon and lemonade. And to that, we can only say,
oh, yeah.
Now, let me tell you, Bob Guthrie and Roker were offered this year either to be waterboarded at Guantanamo or do the parade, so they're going to be in Cuba. It is brutal, is it not?
Well, it is, but in so many ways, that we just heard was an example of absolute masterpiece in the medium of the Macy's Day Parade. Corny writing, bad puns, lots of promotional whatever. It was all there in that 30-second clip. And again, it's not like you've turned off the lights and you're parked in front of the set watching this like you'd watch an episode of Orange is the New Black. It's something that likely you are in another room, lots of other people gathered around. It's the Macy's Day Parade is kind of the equivalent of the centerpiece at the dinner dinner table. It's got to be there. It's pretty ugly, but we, of course, don't pay it much attention to it as the stuff that's on the plates.
Now, are there any, Bob Thompson, are there any classics besides, obviously, the football game and the Macy's Parade that have survived or the years that are traditional on Thanksgiving?
That are worth watching.
Yeah, I mean, I remember years ago, people used to watch E.T., but that was like 15 years ago. I mean, is there anything now?
Yeah, well, that's an interesting question, because what happens is, and of course, Thanksgiving, let's face it now, is a holiday that is centered on two things, both of them deep in the heart of domestic space. One is a football game, and the other is, or a number of football games, and the other is a meal. So this is definitely a television-based holiday, almost as much as Super Bowl Sunday and, I suppose, New Year's Eve, where you need the TV on so you know when midnight comes along. And it is the parade that kind of slides into football or the dog show if you leave it on, but that's not yet a full-blown thing. The other thing is that if there are holiday traditions for other viewing, it tends to be the opening of Christmas classics. We'll get places that will play, A Christmas Story or It's a Wonderful Life in years gone by, and it opens up, just like Santa comes at the end of the Macy's Day Parade, it then opens up that extended season for Christmas. Or there have been times where things, family-oriented movies have come along. If you look at the number of Christmas TV specials versus the number of Thanksgiving specials, Thanksgiving one is a really small slice. Mouse on the Mayflower, a cartoon made in 1968. The Thanksgiving that almost wasn't, 60s or early 70s.
Yeah.
And of course, Charlie Brown Thanksgiving. And
oh, that's right.
Which is great. What's
that's
that?
About all. But movies, there are not as many as Christmas, but there are a couple of real classics. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, John Hughes' film, is not only probably the best Thanksgiving movie, it's one of the best movies. I mean, that really is a wonderfully warm, movie about the holiday. Paul Newman in Nobody's Fool, which is based on the greatest Thanksgiving novel ever written, takes place up in my part of the upstate country and has a snowblower as a major character. Is also that's a movie and a book. Another classic, Pieces of April.
I just had a quick question: is that Paul Newman as a young man or an older man?
Older man.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not that maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah, I've never seen that. I should check it out.
What's Cooking is an interesting Thanksgiving feast, and then one that's getting older now, Home for the Holidays.
Love it.
Probably the most anybody who watches that. It's about a family that's very dysfunctional.
Love
but
it.
It'll seem familiar because, let's face it, dysfunctional is normal.
Yeah.
Love can be filled with arguments and people, throwing the potatoes as opposed to passing them. So there are a couple of really good Thanksgiving movies, and the Thanksgiving scene from Barry Levinson's Avalon has got to be the most depressing scenes ever committed to film.
So on that upbeat note, why is it, as you mentioned a minute ago, I hadn't thought about this, other than Super Bowl Sunday, and even with the new, with a lot of the chain stores opening late Thanksgiving night, this is the classic made-for-TV day. Why aren't TV studios creating new programming for Thanksgiving? Is that because of what you said before? The TV's on anyway, no matter what crap's on is that the notion?
I mean, it is kind of surprising, but I guess to some extent the day is covered. It's just like you could say that more people are watching television on Super Bowl Sunday than any other time of the year. So why aren't they creating more programming for Super Bowl Sunday? Well, they kind of are. They do the Puppy Bowl that tries to get the people that are watching Super Bowl to change the channel during the halftime show. But the fact is, this is a TV-based holiday based on things that have already been decided, the parade in the morning, football in the afternoon. Secondly, I think that by the time you get to Thanksgiving, your programming is anticipating what's coming next. Have you ever noticed that all the great Christmas specials are on before Christmas itself? On Christmas Day, you're hard-pressed to find a Christmas special. And I think Thanksgiving Day is, by the time you get there, they're looking for the whole idea of looking forward to Christmas, and you will see lots and lots of Christmas specials on Thanksgiving and the days immediately following. Matter of fact, I think Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the going on 50-year-old program made during the Johnson administration that still beats its time slot on primetime network TV every year, I think it's playing before Thanksgiving this year.
Hey, we're talking to Bob Thompson from the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. Let's step away from Thanksgiving, as tough as it is, just for a second. You mentioned Orange is the New Black, obviously the Netflix production. Amazon's now getting into the business with something I am dying to see, this Alpha House deal. Let's play a little bite and then tell us a little bit about it. This is Amazon's new series. It stars John Goodman, and it's created by the great Doonesbury cartoonist Gary Trudeau.
Winning is what we do. We're the GOP.
Listen, are you still looking for a place to live?
I am. You joining us? If I can have the upstairs room.
You never handled a gun in your life, have you?
How did you mess that up?
Me. Okay, that's a bit from Alpha House, which is based on the living situation of at least one of our congressmen here.
Maybe two.
With Michael Capuano in Somerville, but definitely Bill Delahunt, who was a congressman for many years. We learned this morning, Bob Thompson, in the local paper, that he's gotten into the medical marijuana business, from Alpha House to the medical marijuana business. But anyway, tell us about this Alpha House and what Amazon is hoping to achieve here.
Yeah, well, they're trying to pull a Netflix, and you get these things free if you sign up for Amazon Prime. That's the $79.99 per year thing that gets you free two-day shipping and all this other video stuff as well. And they think this is going to really jumpstart this. They did an interesting thing. They started in April 19th, I believe it was. They showed a bunch of pilots, and they let people's comments and votes kind of determine which ones were going to go to series. And this was one that the first episode debuted back then. And then they released that and the first, I think it was the first three episodes a couple of weeks ago. And then on November 22nd, Friday, they released another one of their new series called Betas that takes place among, people in the high-tech industry, which is also pretty funny. I actually like that better than Alpha House. So they're doing kind of what Netflix is, not releasing entire series at the same time, but releasing a handful and then on a weekly basis. And if you were to watch any of these things, they could easily be on FX or AMC or one of the premium cable channels. They are high-ticket, big-budget programs with recognizable stars. John Goodman is a big star. And in a strange way, the brand new internet, new media are doing very old school kind of stuff. The comedies are a half hour long, the dramas are an hour long, and they look an awful lot of like the stuff that cable has been doing for quite a while.
And did we make clear Alpha House is about four Republicans, right, living together? And the reason this happens, for people think it isn't real, well, you mentioned Delahunt and Capuano, is a lot of Congress people or senators who are not millionaires have to maintain two households on, what, $170,000 a year. So a lot of these guys, like Mike Capuano and Anthony Weiner, lived together for years in Washington. They lived together to save expenses and apparently to have a little bit of fun. So it's a decent show, though.
Right. I think it's a very funny show. And at first you'd say, well, you know, obviously it's a comedy, so it's over the top. But you mentioned Anthony Weiner. Alpha House hasn't done anything. It wouldn't have dared done that subject yet. It wouldn't have seemed realistic enough.
Tell us about, can we move on from this?
Sure.
Tell us about Sony Pictures. They're moving away from pictures more toward television. And the story I read this morning was all about bottom line, bottom line, bottom line. So what does this mean?
Yeah, well, it is, I guess, all about bottom line, although I don't know what major entertainment industry isn't about bottom line. And I read some of the things that they've just released, and I don't quite get. The Times demand that we set a higher bar, and we have done just that. Okay, you say that at every thing. They're going for innovative entrepreneurial culture and to create creative excellence. I mean, it's kind of this blah, 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 blah.
That's what we do every day here, Bob. Don't poo-poo it, please.
Precisely.
Yes.
Anyway, the interesting part about what I read in this whole statement they made was a significant shift in emphasis from motion pictures to higher margin television. So not just going from movie to TV, but going to higher margin TV. And by that, I interpret it meaning all of this really high class, high pedigree stuff that has been coming out on cable and now direct to internet that many people think is actually more exciting than what's going on in the movies. So, you know, starting with things like The Wire and The Sopranos,
yes,
and then Homeland and Breaking Bad and the rest of it. I mean, it seemed like about 5 years ago, aspiring film students who forever had just wanted to be directors now were starting to more want to be showrunners at HBO or AMC. And now this statement by Sony seems to be they may be going in that same direction.
Well, I like always like overly dramatic summaries of trends in the news. Does this mean we're seeing the beginning of the end of the film industry in movies and more television productions?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, the thing that is really different now, I mean, people predicted the end of the death of movies when television started in the late 1940s.
Give
and
it time.
Movie attendance did go down significantly and has never reached those kinds of attendance numbers. But with the change of, you know, ticket prices raised, the Hollywood figured out how to do that and is still going. The difference now is that television, up until relatively recently, like close to the turn of the century, was not giving us the amount of really high-quality stuff. I mean, overall, I think the in terms of drama, television has probably exceeded the movie.
Amen.
In really high-quality stuff and longer. A Breaking Bad went, 60-some hours as opposed to a two-hour movie. So that we'll have to see. But there still is, as big as our screens and our Dolby surround sound systems are getting, there is still something about going out to the to the movies. And I think maybe we're going to need it more as we go along, since so much of our social activities now are done engaging in screens by ourselves. You know, if you live in a small city or a suburb, when you want to go out with somebody, there's pretty much dinner and a movie. You know,
right.
Living in New York or L.A. or Chicago, there aren't a lot of choices. And you certainly don't want to take your date home where your parents still are, no matter how big your screen.
Yeah, but you can always shoot critters out in the country. Hey, before you go, by the way, one of the issues for me is, will we ever do a segment with Bob Thompson where one of us does not utter the words Breaking Bad? And I surely hope not, no matter how old it becomes. Last thing that's driving me crazy, and I hope you're on the same side here. Anchorman, I loved and thought it was slapstick, low-rent humor at its best. Everybody knows there's a new Anchorman, the sequel or something, coming out. Ron Burgundy is going to Emerson College in early December. It's December 4th. They are renaming the School of Communications for a day. The president, who's a terrific guy, Lee Pelton, says, quote, it will give students a chance to engage with someone who understands the power of media. They're playing it really straight. There are a lot of people in the journalistic community, and I'm assuming some of them are friends of yours in the academic world, who are appalled by the fact that Emerson is honoring, and I use the term in quotes, Ron Burgundy. I think it is brilliant. Where are you on this?
I think it's brilliant, too. And, I mean, if they were naming the entire school forevermore the Ron Burgundy School, that might be a different thing, but I think I'd be okay with that as well.
And by the way, for those who don't know,
he's a real doofus of an anchorman.
Will Ferrell.
Yeah, Will Ferrell. He just reads everything out of the teleprompter, reads things that make no sense, gets in a lot of trouble, real sexist dog. It's a pretty funny
movie.
It's like
if you remember Mary Tyler Moore.
An older generation, just think Ted Baxter.
Exactly.
Ted Baxter. Thank you.
Well, anyway, but not only – okay, so Ron Burgundy's got his own biography coming out, which is exactly what guys like Cronkite and Rather and those did. He's got a school named after him now, which is – so does Cronkite. And there's a you haven't gone to the top that the journalists might really get mad at. There's an exhibit at the museum.
Yep.
This is the, you know, the museum that celebrates the calling of American journalism. There's a Ron Burgundy exhibit there as well. The people who are marketing that movie are doing a brilliant job at it. And I'm only jealous that Emerson got this offer. I wish Syracuse would have gotten the offer.
I am so with you. Hey, Bob, thank you as always. That was great.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks.
Happy
Bob,
Thanksgiving.
Have a wonderful Turkey Day, Bob. Bob Thompson, frequent guest of ours, the founding director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communication at Syracuse University. And obviously that was not Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory. As I said before when I was introducing, that was Bob Thompson. So this time, I'm going to get it correct, up next is Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory. We're going to talk to him about, among other things, 60 Minutes is spending Laura Logan, one of their reporters, for a horrible mistake in a report involving Benghazi. Stay tuned for that conversation. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Imagine world peace.
Okay, imagine Hanukkah and Thanksgiving getting together. Yummy.
You are going to see a lot of sweet potato latkes this year. Brussels sprout latkes.
Won't happen again for 70,000 years. One turkey, 8 days, and a dreidel or two. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Christmas City at Seasons 4, featuring a large selection of fresh and artificial trees and wreaths, plus gifts and holiday decorations, including ribbons, lights, and ornaments. Open every day on Mass Ave in Lexington. Seasons4.com. And North Coast Brewing Company, makers of Brother Thelonious, a Belgian-style Abbey Ale, presenting Arturo Sandoval Friday, November 29th at 10 p.m. with Eric Jackson live from Scullers Jazz Club here on WGBH. More at northcoastbrewing.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as he does every Wednesday on the phone, is the editor of the Boston Globe. That would be Brian McGrory. Hey, Brian.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Good.
Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
Hey, happy almost Thanksgiving, Brian McGrory.
To you as well.
So I am dying to ask you. You had it in the Metro front today, and we've been talking about it for the last couple of days. This smoking. Did you ever smoke cigarettes, Brian McGrory?
I never smoke cigarettes. I've always been very against cigarette smoking.
Oh, good for you.
Good. So ask him the question
then.
Perfect.
Because I used to think I wouldn't be able to write a story without smoking my way through it. When I first worked at the Herald, I used to walk in there, and there'd be like 3 feet of smog from cigar smoke.
It's like Beijing at the Boston Herald.
There was like a yellow haze in the newsroom. But anyway, I wonder what you think about this ban on smoking, even in parks. I know we're banning it everywhere now, but Boston Common, can't walk through Boston Common and have a cigarette anymore. Are you with Jim on this, who wants to like keep people from smoking in their homes?
Look, I don't think I'm supposed to have a public opinion on this. That said, I love it. I hate the idea that I can be walking through the Boston Public Garden or the Boston Common or along the Esplanade, although I guess that doesn't really that's not really affected by this.
Not yet.
No, but I hate sucking in somebody else's smoke. I absolutely hate it. And if I had my way, it would be banned on sidewalks as well. If people want to smoke in their yards, in their houses, in their cars, they're perfectly free to, but don't expose me. Don't shove your smoke up my nostrils.
We should just end this right here. That was, let me tell you, there was a thrill up my leg when I heard that. Marjorie, you know what I said to you earlier today, but Brian didn't get to hear this? You like going to Wingashique, for example? I know it's not covered by this. There's nothing like going to the beach in the summer and having
cigarette
butts littered all around you.
2013. You can't smoke on beaches almost anywhere anymore. I don't think you have to worry about
Marjorie, I'm still having a hard time with this thrill up my leg line, if you could help me out here. Not since Scott Brown used to text him every couple of days.
He hasn't texted me in months.
His Jim had that experience before, and now I'm part of it.
Yeah, well, it's true, because Scott indeed has not texted Jim in months, and it's been a little difficult for Jim, and he's wondering if you could text him a little bit more, Brian.
Silence.
How could I do it anymore, Jim? We go back and forth 10 times a day, for God's sake.
Doesn't get much better than that, Brian. You know, Brian, speaking of smoking of another kind, the Herald had, now you have this story about former pals, the Delahunts, the Finnerans, former Speaker of the House, obviously Bill Delahunt, former congressman from the South Shore and the Cape, now are in the medical marijuana dispensary business. And as Marjorie and I were talking about this morning, it is all perfectly legal. But isn't there a piece of this that seems, I don't know if it's unseemly is the right word, but it is. It's sort of like they're cashing in on political connections, no?
Well, I mean, it would seem like there's got to be some element of that, I would think. It also makes you kind of raise your eyebrows at the amount of money that might be involved here if the people of this type are rushing for the entrances. So it's why we're paying attention, Marjorie. It's why you guys have, and you know, it bears watching. But look at it. You know, we'd be foolish not to take a look at whether there are political connections involved in getting these permits or whatever you call them.
Yeah, the point you made a minute ago in the story in your paper today, I can't remember who wrote it, but there's a great quote from someone who said, and I'm paraphrasing, says something like, if you get one of these things and can't make $1 million, you're an idiot. And
yeah, gold rush. A person called it a gold rush.
It really, and by the way, I supported it. I did 2/3 of the people in Massachusetts. So it's perfectly legal yet again, but it just is weird, this revolving door thing.
You know what it's like, Brian? This reminds me, if we turned around tomorrow and legalized prostitution, and suddenly Bill Delahunt and Guy Glotis, the fourth sheriff, Tom Sinner, they're running brothels. I mean, you would just see, okay, it's legal, it's fine. Delahunt, particularly, I mean, I get a kick out of Delahunt.
What's wrong with that?
Well, he was a district attorney.
I know what he was.
He was putting people in jail for years for possession of marijuana, never mind selling marijuana. So it's a weird sort of turnaround,
I guess. On the flip side of that, and I don't know where you guys are on Tom Finneran, didn't he get convicted in federal court?
He did, of a felony. As a matter of fact, he did. Meaning, is he barred from this sort of thing?
Yeah, apparently not, huh?
Well, I guess not. I mean,
that's a great point. Well, he's a lobbyist for
Yeah, I don't know if he's
companies.
A lawyer again, but he's I guess he's a lobbyist. He said, what was the line again in your story? Was that he provides a roadmap to Massachusetts. So
the story, by the way, was done by Frank Phillips, our great state house.
It was great.
Oh, Frank.
Josh,
I know Frank.
Miller, yeah.
So how long do you think we are away from legalizing everything altogether? I was out in Colorado earlier this month, and starting in January, you can just walk into your 7-Eleven and
Colorado and Washington.
Colorado and Washington.
But, you know, there was
state.
A national poll last week. I don't know if you saw this, Brian. While a significant majority, thankfully, supports marijuana for medicinal purposes. I can't believe anybody, I don't care what your politics are, oppose a doctor prescribing marijuana if he or she thinks it's the best thing. But amazingly to me, considering the trends in all these polls and people's tolerance, a majority do not support the legalization of marijuana across the board, even though the conventional wisdom is this medicinal marijuana ballot question was a foot in the door.
Well, let me ask you something, and it's a semi-serious question.
Yeah.
If you are using marijuana for medicinal purposes, could you smoke it in a public park in Boston?
We were
where
just
you can't smoke cigarettes.
I was just going to ask you that question and how you would. I don't know what the
well,
law
I
is.
I think
about
I
that.
Do know because.
But I think it would be interesting to see if the same people that object to the smell of tobacco smoke would object as much to the smell of marijuana
well,
smoke.
Well, I think the public health people who were quoted in the Globe story this morning, that apparently was written by Frank Phillips and somebody else, apparently say that's part of the issue they want to deal with too. So I think the answer is yeah, all smoking kinds of things are covered by that, including marijuana.
You have to use a water bong, as they used to use back in the college
okay,
days.
Okay, Marjorie,
you know
fine. Hey, Brian, you know, there are days when I am jealous, and I mean this sincerely, of the great job you have, and there are days when I say it's the last thing I'd ever want responsibility for. This Lara Logan story, obviously a celebrated journalist who lived through a horrible experience at Tahrir Square, I guess a couple of years ago, suspended by CBS yesterday for, she and her producer suspended, for failing to properly vet their story on Benghazi that everybody's talking about, this Dylan Davies guy who said to them that he scaled the walls of the American compound, was inside the hospital, and had confirmed that the ambassador, Chris Stevens, was dead. In fact, he had told his employer, the FBI, and other people he was actually nowhere near there at that particular time. What, for the average person listening to this show, when you do something that's really cutting edge, heavy investigative stuff, what kind of internal vetting has to happen so that people like you can sleep comfortably at night?
It's funny you use that phrase, sleep comfortably at night, because it's the exact phrase I use in here all the time. I want to be able, when we have a great, hard-hitting investigative report, I want to be able to know I can sleep through the night on the night it's getting published. And if I can't, that means there's something wrong with it, that we haven't done all we can do to make sure that everything in it is absolutely correct, that our sources are straightforward, that the documents are legitimate. There is a lot of vetting that goes into it. We have multiple lines of editors that go through it. We have some of the best investigative reporters in the country. We like to think we go at this cautiously. Look, stuff slips through. I'm really surprised about the 60 Minutes deal. You know, I had been under the impression that they had some of the most exhaustive vetting in the news media industry, and I'm really, really surprised about this. But you know, I'd be foolish to say we don't all live in fear of something like this happening to us.
You know, most people who are not in the business, the only thing they know about what happens in the business is by watching Jeff Daniels in the Newsroom. Do you watch Newsroom, by the way?
You know, I've never, is that one of these extra pay channels that I never subscribe to?
Yeah, HBO.
It's schlocky, but I have to say I like it. But let me get the thought out here, Marjorie. Is that when they were doing their story that was the major theme of, I think, season two, which tended out ultimately ended up being Cooked, they talked about an independent panel that had nothing to do with the development of the story inside the new, I can't remember what the name of the station is, the fictitious station. Does that happen in newspapers? Is there a separate entity of people who are not working on the investigative report who then get it presented to them prior to it being presented to the reader?
Not. We don't call them an independent panel. They're simply called editors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you will have an editor on an investigative team. Take our spotlight team. Hugely successful and terrific at what they do. But ultimately, their stories will be read by a projects editor and a managing editor and myself. And we will look at this, look at their material, and make sure that we are completely comfortable. We'll ask questions. We'll probe. We'll do everything we should be doing. But no, is there a formal independent panel? No, because we like to think in our system we don't need that.
You know, Brian, I don't want to embarrass the Boston Herald, but I have no choice here in the spirit of full disclosure. Do you know
what are you talking about?
The huge embarrassment that the Herald suffered when Marjorie and I relied upon the reporting of a story several years ago? Have I ever told you this before?
No, what?
There was a story.
Marjorie, I'm going to cut him off.
It's a great story, and she is a great reporter.
Okay, whatever.
Who made a mistake.
She's one of my favorite reporters,
she's
actually. But here's what happened. There was a great story.
We should probably not name her.
Fine, let's not name her. You can Google her. There was a great story in the, you know, we used to have a radio show on another station. I don't know if you're aware of that. Near the Globe, actually. And what happened was there was a story that was damning. Remember Diane Wilkerson? Remember her, the state senator?
Of course.
Yes.
Okay, she filed a report with the Office of Campaign and Political Finance, in which she reported that she spent $160 out of her campaign account on her brassiere. Now, that's outrageous.
I would you not? It was only $60.
No, it was $160. Is that? Would you agree that was outrageous on its face?
Look, I have no idea.
Trust me, it's outrageous. It's not. I don't mean it's $160 is a lot for a brassiere. I'm not suggesting you would know that.
It's a lot for a
brassiere. I'm saying it's a lot out of a campaign account. Right, so, in any case, Marjorie and I, doing what we do masterfully on our former radio station, spent an hour eviscerating Diane Wilkerson.
Was this before or after your independent panel went through it for you?
We didn't need an independent
panel.
There
was no independent panel.
Okay, so what happened is this. We did this hour, and I have to say it was brilliant radio.
It was a riot.
We leave the radio station. My phone rings, and I pick up the phone, and I go, hi, it's Jim Browder. She says, hi, this is Senator Wilkerson. And I said, Senator, I'm really sorry, but you know, but we had to do what we had to do. It was really. She said, no, I don't quarrel with you doing what you had to do. But the only problem was the original story said I spent $160 on a brassiere. I actually spent $160 at Brasserie Joe's to take out my staff at the end of the campaign.
Oh,
so,
God.
I mean,
it was awful.
Would you not agree that was like a huge embarrassment for the paper and our radio station? What's your position on that, Brian?
Seriously, what did you do to correct it?
The next day, we got on the air. We said, by the way, we made a mistake about Brasserie Joe yesterday. It was really and that was it. We covered the whole thing. That's a true story, sadly.
But you know what? Something, Brian, to get back to is the serious thing about people misrepresenting themselves and who they are. I think it's less of an issue in investigative pieces where you have more time for the most part. To me, it's always scary on the street, on breaking news. You know, you go out to cover, for example, that horrible family slaying in Arlington last week.
Yeah.
And you do it. You always do it. You go to the neighbors, right? And you're interviewing these neighbors, and they're telling you their names and where they live, and they're telling you this and that about the people that were in this horrible tragedy. And many times, people have no idea who these neighbors are, if they're legit, if their stories are. You know what I'm saying? You're at a fire, you're at a murder, you're at some breaking news story. That's where I think lots of times you think, God, I hope this. Because you find everybody is sort of a gang mentality. You know, the TV station had the same neighbor. The newspapers had the same neighbor. Everybody's got
it's
the
like
same
Franklin
neighbor.
It's like Franklin Street in Watertown on the Friday after the marathon bombing when everybody was giving interviews.
And so that's what I find scary sometimes. Is
but and I agree with that. But, you know, misinformation, bad information doesn't seem like it would sway a story quite as much in that situation as something like the false stories in the Benghazi issue on 60
deal.
Minutes.
That
was a big deal. And look, Marjorie, you and I know that there are times, and it's probably happened to you, I know it's happened to me, when you really fall in love with a storyline and you start ignoring clues or traces of things that can violate what you want to be the truth. And that's where...
Right, that's a very good point.
That's where editors, good editors on TV, good producers, blow the whistle on this stuff and hit the pause button.
Never happened to me. Okay, Brian.
No, I've made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah,
I must admit.
Okay, we don't need to... We discussed one. We don't have to talk about that. Okay, Brian, let's talk about a few things inside the newspaper because I know you love doing that for a couple of minutes. We're talking to the editor of the Boston Globe. You're on Friday, your wraparound cover of the newspaper with the actual newspaper from, obviously, the 50 years ago when JFK was assassinated. I didn't hear anybody who was, to use a double negative, who was not totally wowed by this thing. When you anticipate that coming out, do you print more newspapers? Do you decide, we know people are going to want to keep this thing, want to have this thing, let's print an extra 10, 15, 20? What do you do with that?
You know, it's an interesting question. I don't think on this one we did. I do know that we did sell out in a lot of places. People really really seemed to like it. I loved it. I hope you guys did too.
Helen Thomas and
it was a great idea.
How did Helen Thomas refer to Jackie Kennedy as a lovely lady? In the it was great.
She wrote a beautiful lead. Yeah. She wrote a beautiful lead. Bob Healy had the main story, and you know, under incredible deadline pressure, wrote an amazing story. My own cousin Mary McGorry was on the front page, the bottom of the front page, with the scene out of Andrews Air Force Base when Air Force One arrived with President Kennedy's body. I thought it was the best way to capture the mood of the day and of that era back in 1963, and thought it worked out well. It was the idea in here of our main designer, Dan Zedek.
Good for him. That's great.
It was just a great idea, and we were delighted to do it.
It was a very weepy week for the baby boomers. We were all beside ourselves for the whole week.
Well, it really did kind of transport you back to that era and what might have been, what could have been, what really is. I don't know. It was a strange week.
Yeah. Hey, Brian, we hear yesterday your boss, the new owner of the paper, is selling the Worcester T&G, or hopes to sell the Worcester T&G, hopefully to local owners as well. What impact, if any, does that have on you people?
Just Marjorie, just trace back a second. When I said that about transporting back, is that Jim's idea of getting nostalgic when he says, yeah.
No,
yeah,
I was. Okay. I know. If you want
cut,
me to say.
Cut me right off. I was going to go. I was going to wax
go ahead.
Nostalgic for a minute.
Do you want me to say the David Shribman piece on RFK
was a great piece.
Unbelievable?
No, Shribman wrote on the impact
on
the
Irish. Irish.
I'm sorry.
On
that's
the
right.
Irish.
It was one of the greatest essays I have ever read. What? It was classic David Shribman, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning Washington bureau chief of the Globe for many years now, the editor-in-chief of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Eric Moskowitz, just an utterly delightful story, a beautiful story on Friday of people's reactions to what happened that day, what was going on in Boston on that day.
Did you hear the BSO thing that was played on the radio? You may have missed that.
Yes, yeah.
That was unbelievable, the way everybody heard about that. But, you know, you're Irish. I'm Irish, Brian. I think I'm older than you are, but you're probably old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination. But before the assassination, how big a deal was Shribman captured? I get very annoyed when people talk about the Irish need not apply because that was 100 years ago. But at the time that Kennedy died, remember, if you were Catholic, you weren't supposed to go to a Protestant church. You really weren't supposed to have that many Protestant friends, never mind Jewish friends. There was this whole underdog mentality among the Irish, you know, and I don't know when your family came here, but we were second generation. There was a whole underdog mentality, which Kennedy lifted. And that was such a huge thing in my family and probably in your family, and which is why I think we so related to this, because it brought us back to that time in our lives.
Agreed. And again, I thought David did an extraordinary job capturing that for our readers. It was really, really well done.
It was great. It was great. And how the dreams were just shattered and everything else.
And how he represented a different kind of Irish politician, so different than even what we see at the South Boston St. Patrick's Day breakfast.
The lace curtain.
It was a much more refined Irish Catholic politician.
Well, you know, I've told this story before to Jim, and I'll tell it to you along in those lines. I mean, in my family, and I don't know about yours, but the whole thing was to rise up and to become more WASP-like, frankly. We were supposed to, you know, you're supposed to become like the people that your grandmother was working for, you know, and there was that striving. And we weren't big into the, like, until I got to Boston, I'd never seen such a big thing about these Irish songs and this almost obsession with Ireland. In my family, it was all about, forget Ireland, let's become very successful Americans. And the Kennedys represented that, you know, the height of success for the Irish in a way that was very different. You're absolutely right. No South Boston about it at all.
Yeah, yeah, and that was, you know, look at if you can pick a way to do it, that was a pretty good roadmap right there.
So now if I bring up the Worcester T&G, I feel like a total loser.
I have never heard Jim this quiet this long on his show. Well, this is really. Did he go out and get a? Did he go out and get a cigarette or something like that? Is that what he did?
That will never happen. Trust me.
I don't get to talk much, Brian. So I take advantage of those moments.
Those were beautiful stories.
When I can.
I was taking them in.
You know what he was doing while I was saying this?
What?
He was motioning me, Brian.
No,
hurry
stop. That
up,
is totally.
Hurry
that,
up, hurry
Marjorie,
up.
Say
hurry
that
up.
Isn't true. Maybe a little bit. So how about the T&Gs? Have any effect on you or no?
No,
that's it.
The Worcester paper is a terrific paper. They do great work out there. It's an important paper in Massachusetts. And John Henry has said that he thinks they will prosper better with truly local ownership, just like the Globe is prospering or will prosper with local ownership. And you know, I think it's a good idea to see what's out there, see who wants to own that paper from that community, and could be very effective.
There are the reports that the fact that your publisher, who obviously preceded John Henry, went to the Worcester T&G with him, suggests that he's staying, which suggests that there's going to be stability internally. Is that how you read it too?
Read.
I don't mean the article, but is the sense that Henry is staying the course with the leadership that he's got there?
Oh, God, I mean, I'm not going to go anywhere near that. You've asked me that before,
okay,
and
well,
I know we have a great publisher, and, you know, I expect we'll continue on the course we are.
Now, Brian, I have a Thanksgiving question for you. You wrote a book, of course, a great book, if people haven't read it, Buddy, How Rooster Made Me a Family Man. I wonder, having grown attached in your own kind of odd way to the rooster, not in an untoward way, I mean, just you became to
okay,
have
ahead,
a
Marjorie.
Grudging thing with the rooster. How do you feel about turkeys on Thanksgiving? Does it bother you to eat them?
I eat chicken almost every day, Marjorie, and I eat it. I eat it with a vengeance. So turkey is great too. Any feathered creature is just fine by
okay.
me.
Okay, you don't think of Buddy at all with his little home out there in the backyard.
It's funny. I was. Jim was probably doing the same thing. I was stacking wood over the weekend.
I did.
Was
yeah.
I was using Buddy's old house to stack some firewood to keep it dry.
Oh,
you
haven't replaced Buddy?
We have not replaced Buddy.
Okay.
And I'd appreciate if we kept any thoughts like that to ourselves.
Hey, Brian, you ever want to spend a weekend with me? We go chop some wood together or something? Maybe Saturday. I'll call. You know, forget right now. I'll call you Friday. Maybe Saturday we can do that.
Well, we'll discuss it in our afternoon texting.
Brian McGrory, Editor of the Globe. Happy Thanksgiving, Brian. We'll talk to you next week.
To you guys.
Happy
Take
Thanksgiving,
care.
Brian. Thank you as always for being with us. Brian McGrory is editor of the Boston Globe. He joins us every Wednesday at right around 1 o'clock. When we come back, it's time for.
Excuse me.
Yep.
I'd like to read you a text I received seconds ago.
Oh, great.
I'll only read part of it. Heard you miss me. I miss you as well. Now, who might that be from?
It couldn't be.
Well, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't.
From Senator Scott Brown?
It's a former Senator Scott. Maybe from him, yes.
Jim,
just wanted to update people.
Now we're cooking. Okay, when we come back, it's time for Open Mic with our Lawyer Up Edition. David Frank, Managing Editor of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly, joins us. We're going to talk about Sarnia. We're going to talk about Whitey Bulger, some breaking news. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
When animators want to make a funny movie even funnier, they bend the rules of gravity. But they don't break them. Case in point, Toy Story.
Toys are trying to kill each other. They're like throwing each other out of windows into the jaws of dogs. I remember thinking like, wow, where there's great peril, there's great room for comedy.
Building big animated laughs, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you. And Newbridge on the Charles in Dedham, a vibrant senior community offering residents a bridge to a meaningful retirement. You can learn more or schedule a tour at experiencenewbridge.org. That's experiencenewbridge.org. And Atlas Liquors, featuring wines, artisanal spirits, and micro-brewed beers. You can visit Natalie and her brothers at one of their three locations in Medford, Quincy, and Roslindale. Online at atlasliquors.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And joining us for our Lawyer Up edition is of Open Mic is David Frank. David is the managing editor of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. David, welcome back.
Do you and Brian need a third when the wood chopping begins?
Can you imagine? You know me a little bit. Can you imagine me going out and chopping wood, or even you?
It would be my first piece of wood that I'd ever chopped, so it would be an experience, that's for sure.
I'm proud of you, David.
Hey, David, thank you very much for joining us. So, as you know, David, the Supreme Court just yesterday agreed to hear a pair of cases on whether corporations can provide insurance coverage for contraception, can opt out of it based on their religious beliefs. So, what's going to happen? Is this really significant, and what's going to happen with this?
It's significant that they're taking it. I mean, the Supreme Court, the vast majority of requests for lawyers that want their cases heard are rejected. The fact that they're taking it is significant. And when you look at the sort of the state of the law across the country, there's at least two different courts that have addressed the question and come up with a different answer. So when you have circuit splits, when you have judges look at the same fact patterns and reach different conclusions, you know, that's where the Supreme Court comes in, and that's where a judge like Chief Justice Roberts is going to be so instrumental, because he was in many ways sort of the swing vote back in 2012 when the Obamacare was first before the court. So, yes, very significant.
Well, you know, it's not just comparing it to their earlier Obamacare decision, which obviously made the president happy. It all flows, well, from one case I'll mention in a minute, and also an infamous set of comments by a guy who ran for president recently. Here's Mitt Romney.
Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on, of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So, where do you think it goes?
What?
Whose pockets? Whose pockets? People's pockets. Okay, human beings, my friend.
Wow, that was an angry mob with Mitt Romney. But the point there, the corporations are people, David Frank. It seems to me that the argument that's going to be made by those who say that CEOs who have religious objections to things like contraception should be able to exclude that from their health care coverage are going to say, hey, this very same Supreme Court said in the infamous Citizens United case that corporations have free speech rights. That's why billionaires can spend tens of millions to affect the outcomes of political campaigns. And if they have free speech rights under the First Amendment, then they have freedom of religion under the First Amendment. And as a result, Obama and women are going to come out on the short end of this. Isn't that a fairly reasonable prediction?
No.
Why?
It's not, Attorney Browdy. It's
why?
Not that I mean, I'm not. Don't ask me to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. But I think what you're going to see is you're going to see the court being presented with two, I think, otherwise valid interests. I mean, it's clear that the Constitution gives owners of corporations, not the corporations themselves, but the owners of corporations have the right to go into court and object on religious grounds to a provision that would have an impact on their religious freedom. But it's going to be up to the other side to sort of present a rational basis for the provision. So it's not an easy call. There's anybody who says they know what's going to happen has no idea what's going to happen. I mean, you've got two legitimate constitutional interests that are at play, and it really does come down to how the Supreme Court sort of decides to balance. I mean, we know from 2012 that, at least in that particular case, that the balance went a particular way. But this is not an easy call. I mean, it's a situation where two legitimate constitutional interests are being weighed against each other, and I think the government's going to have to be able to really convince the court that they have rational reasons for wanting to do this.
Well,
but I know you like to, Jim, wrap it up in an easy answer. It's not an easy answer.
Well, I'm glad, by the way, it's not an easy answer, because I was assuming if Citizens United is where the court is, then this is where they're going to be here.
But you know what I think is most exciting about this is the politics of it, because stories I was reading this morning say the oral arguments could come in, you know, March, April, midterm elections. You know, people say that the base is like, get the base revved up. Well, this will rev up the GOP base, but it could end up backfiring on the GOP if we were talking about contraception all spring and all fall, because that a lot of women do not like to hear that they're immoral for using contraception. You know what I'm saying?
You see how, David, how Marjorie likes to wrap things up neatly politically? Do you notice that with
her? No, it's very nice to get, especially around Thanksgiving, you know, and Hanukkah. Jim, happy Hanukkah.
Same to you, of course.
It's nice to try to wrap it up in a little bow, but some of these things are really complicated. And I agree, Marjorie, that if the dialogue around the country is sort of focused on those issues, it may not play well for the Republicans, but I don't think it's a surprise that there are a string of cases that are coming out of this very controversial law that went into effect just a couple of years ago. This is not going to be the last Obamacare case that goes before the Supreme Court, and it's certainly going to be, I think, an important chapter along the way, but so many variables are going to go into how the court ultimately decides to rule on this thing.
Matt, I want you to know, David Frank, you've been on the air with us about 3.5 minutes. You have not said the website yet of Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. What, are you not feeling well?
Well, MassLawyersWeekly.com is good. I'm not feeling well because I waited outside for that stretch limousine you guys promised to drive me to the studio. And so I'm just trying to dry off and entertain the listeners at the same time.
You know, David, you said that I was making something simple that's complicated. This next thing I think is complicated. Maybe you'll tell me it's simple. Flowing out of Citizens United, again, the Supreme Court case where they said free speech rights allow individuals and corporations to spend immense amounts of money like they did in this most recent campaign. That's the Citizens United case. It seems to me that what President Obama is trying to do, I hope he's successful, but I want to know if he has the legal right to do this, is trying to circumvent the Citizens United ruling by yesterday saying, by executive order, we're going to change the Internal Revenue Service regulations. So so-called tax-exempt corporations, I used to run one not that long ago, can spend a far more limited amount of their money on social welfare activities, otherwise known as political activities, so that they can't be spending these millions and tens of millions of dollars like some corporations and some unions did. Does he have the power to do what he's attempting to do, it seems to me, through the back door?
I think it's going to be tricky. I mean, he certainly has the power to do what he's doing now, which is basically make a set of proposed rules that will then go through a lengthy bureaucratic process in which there will be a period where people can submit public comments either in favor or in opposition to the proposal. There are going to be public hearings. There's going to be additional review. I mean, it's a very long process to sort of vet the issue and have a discussion. I think the president probably wants, and Barack Obama did not call me to explain his rationale, but I think he wants the dialogue. He clearly is uncomfortable with the way things have been going, and certainly the definition of political activity has been a real thorn in the side of this whole issue. And I think that by putting these proposals out there, he must know that if this ever were to go into effect, there would be immediate challenges. There would be arguments that it is sort of unfairly targeting certain groups while turning a blind eye to other groups. But I think he wants to get a dialogue going, and he will certainly succeed at doing that.
Well, it's not to get a dialogue going. The reality is there's no, with this same Supreme Court, the likelihood that they'll overturn their recent decision in Citizens United is nil. A lot of liberal politicians, including from our state, have talked about a constitutional amendment to overturn it. That's not happening anytime soon. So it seems he's either got to live with it or attempt to do it through this regulatory process. So win or lose, I assume he thinks this is his only avenue, no?
But if he wins, and then he clearly will be in court defending it, and he'd have to give some sort of explanation for why there is that rational basis for doing it, for presumably targeting certain groups, certain Tea Party groups, and putting extra scrutiny on them while not doing it for other groups. And I think it'd be a problem. I mean, it's not to say that he couldn't find arguments to make in front of the court. This is one I don't think he could win if it got that far.
Well, let me just say, now I'm not speaking as a lawyer or a former lawyer. I'm speaking as someone who used to run nonprofits, including these exact same kind of nonprofits. 15 and 20 years ago, David, and I'm sure you know this, the Internal Revenue Service was incredibly restrictive, and there was a huge amount of scrutiny in terms of what percentage of your total revenues could be expended on political activity. And it had to be a really – there was no – number as such, but there were sort of rules of thumb, and the rules of thumb would never have allowed the kind of spending that we saw in the last presidential election. So there is some historical precedent for what the IRS did, which I assume he can argue. So it's not like I'm just trying to crack down on Karl Rove and his friends.
Well, and again, you could certainly read a great legal news publication like Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly at MassLawyersWeekly.com.
Yeah, I heard that, yeah.
Did you get that? Yeah.
Oh, it's at .com. Yeah, I know that. Yeah, .com, yeah.
So
two big things have happened since those ancient times that you speak of, Jim.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court has weighed in with the decision, and the IRS earlier this year was embroiled in clearly an embarrassing scandal.
That's a good point.
In which, there was targeting of certain Tea Party groups and groups that had the word patriot in its name. So those are facts that the opposition is not going to ignore if and when they were ever to challenge it. And I think on this one, it's going to be really difficult for them to ever get a regulation like this into effect. They certainly can get public comments. They can certainly open it up for discussion. But no chance in France is my valid legal opinion there.
Just a quick breaking news thing I wanted to ask you about before we get to Zohar Tsarnaev and the death penalty. The Boston Herald website is reporting that Whitey Bulger has just been moved from the Plymouth County House of Correction to an undisclosed site. Do you have any inkling on where he might end up? And does he go from it to an interim place and then go to the Supermax? Or does he not go to the Supermax because he's 84 years old? What will happen to him?
Well, and I will say this. I've talked to numerous people I can speak to it because enough of it is on record. I think there's reports out there now that he's in Brooklyn at a facility in New York, essentially being classified. He's at the same facility where one of the co-defendants in the Sal DeMasi began his sentence. It is certainly not a comfortable place. Many people who are spending time in the facility that Bulger's in right now don't like it. It's very restrictive. It is not the typical club fed that you read about. But
right.
You're right, Marjorie. He's not going to be there for a long time. He will be classified at that facility, I'm told, and then be sent elsewhere to serve his sentence, whether that's Colorado or some other facility, I think pretty far away from the Northeast, remains to be seen. But the other thing that's out there is sooner rather than later, Bulger's going to be on a plane headed to Florida, because Florida is next in line to at least address the charges that they have against him there. He is facing death penalty charges in Florida and Oklahoma. I don't think either state is going to move forward with their death penalty cases, but they haven't said that yet. They haven't concluded that yet. And everything I hear, and I talk to the three lead prosecutors here in Boston, they all think that he is going to Florida in the next couple of weeks, if not next couple of months.
But does someone as old as he is go to one of these supermax prisons or not?
Well, I mean, his medical situation is clearly going to be an issue.
Yep.
And he will be evaluated for the obvious issues that I imagine most people in their mid-80s are facing. If he's in a medical facility, it is not going to be a carpeted Brigham and Women's Hospital or anything nice. It's going to be a very difficult existence for Mr. Bulger either way.
You mentioned the death penalty, and obviously what a lot of people are waiting to hear is what Eric Holder, the Attorney General, decides on this death penalty or no death penalty for Jahar Tsarnaev. And for those who say, well, how can there be a death penalty when the crime was committed within Massachusetts? While committed within Massachusetts, obviously, I assume most people know, state law, there's no death penalty. When you're prosecuted under federal law, you can have a death penalty be the ultimate sentence. What are the criteria? What is Eric Holder looking at, and what is the likelihood that he decides that the death penalty is appropriate punishment for Tsarnaev?
Well, you're right, Jim, that the charges that he's – numerous charges against him right now in the federal system allow for a death penalty. What's already happened is a panel of lawyers within the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Massachusetts have made a recommendation to Eric Holder, either recommending death or not recommending death. I think it's disappointing that the U.S. Attorney's Office opted not to make their decision public, so we don't know what it is.
Do U.S. attorney – wait, before you go ahead, David, ordinarily do U.S. attorney's offices in these matters, do they make them public, their recommendations to the attorney general?
Marjorie, he's asking tough questions today.
What is the answer?
He is. He's an attorney at law.
It's a good question that you certainly can find answers to at masslawyersweekly.com.
Why are we not, David, in a moment of seriousness here, why are we not entitled? I mean, we've had these discussions with Brian McGrory about the Todashev investigation in Florida, where the FBI will say absolutely. And this is an endless series of lack of transparency. What argument, if Carmen Ortiz was on the phone right now and you turned to her and said, U.S. Attorney Ortiz, why is the public not entitled to know in their name what your recommendation to their U.S. To the Attorney General is? What would her answer be?
It's an internal process. It's the internal workings of the. I totally disagree with this answer I'm giving you, and so if
no, I hear
she
you.
Wants to, but I think she would say the internal workings of the executive branch of a prosecutor's office are work product. It's not. There's no reason why they should have to disclose their reasoning. I think that's ridiculous.
So do I.
The three of us have already talked about how crazy it is that the things that happen inside the courtroom aren't public. I mean, I was at the hearing, the last Tsarnaev hearing a couple of weeks ago. It was fascinating stuff. There were real arguments back and forth between the prosecution and the defense about what the trial should be, about how it should proceed. None of us got to see it.
No cameras in the courtroom. It's pathetic.
So there's no good argument.
Do you know something? I just want to say, because I've written about this in the Herald, I have called now over the last 3 weeks emailed every single member of our delegation, Markey, Warren, all the congresspeople, on what they're going to do about this in terms of this trial, because if the courtroom is still closed to cameras, that means that people who have suffered severe injuries in the Marathon bombing, if they do not physically go to the courtroom, they will not see the procedures. And even if they do, they're going to be in an overflow courtroom because the courtroom can't accommodate all the people that want to come see the trial. They haven't even gotten back to me. They have
they're going to get back and say that nothing's going to change. How is that different than what happened in Bulger? There were so many.
But there's legislation pending right now to open up the courtrooms. Patrick Leahy is one of the co-sponsors from Vermont. Chuck Schumer has sponsored it. This legislation has been sponsored every year, I think, since 2005.
By the way, Republicans do. But, David, we only have 1 minute left. Quickly, what is your sense of what do a little Nostradamus thing? What is Eric Holder going to do, and why is he going to do what he does?
He's going to seek the death penalty because if he doesn't seek it here, what case will he ever seek it on? And he's also going to do it because it just allows the government to have some leverage moving forward in the event that there is some kind of an agreement to Tsarnaev to pleading to, say, life without the possibility of being released. It just gives him more leverage. So he's going to seek the death penalty. And that's January 31st. Is the deadline for that decision.
That's my next question.
David.
You answered it. David Frank.
What's the website, David?
Oh, that's a great question, Marjorie. It's masslawyersweekly.com.
Let me write that down. Hold
okay.
a second. David's great
website. David Frank MLW on Twitter is a
okay.
lot of fun, too.
It's great to talk to you, David.
We hope David
Thanks
Frank
for your time.
and the website massachusettslawyersweekly.com have a wonderful Thanksgiving. When we come back,
see you, David.
David, thank you very much. When we come back, Jonathan Alsop, founder of the Boston Wine School, is dropping by to get us in the Thanksgiving or Thanksgiving spirit. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Brian O'Donovan. For me, the must-haves for any, and indeed every great get-together, are music, laughter, and of course a few surprises. And you can be sure A Christmas Celtic Sojourn has them all. I hope you and your family can make it this year. Shows are selling out across New England. Get your tickets at wgbh.org/Celtic.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Merrimack Repertory Theatre, presenting the romantic comedy Stella and Lou, asking if a second chance at love is possible for two people with a lot of miles on them. On stage November 29th through December 22nd, mrt.org. And Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, dedicated to helping its members live happier, healthier lives. It's not just Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. It's Blue Cross Blue Shield of you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Jonathan Alsop, freshly back from Shanghai, I should say. We'll find out about that in a minute. Is the founder of the Boston Wine School. We've talked to you about television on Thanksgiving, food on Thanksgiving. He is here and has brought the holiday cheer with him to tell us what to drink on Thanksgiving. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey.
How are you?
Hi, Jonathan.
Hey guys,
thank
how are
you for
you?
Coming. And he's very elegantly dressed
because
he's going on Greater Boston.
Thank you. Thanks.
Tonight
thanks,
at 7 o'clock.
Thanks so much. On the radio, no one can tell you're wearing pajamas.
They can't.
Or less.
But you on TV.
Yeah, but you know, I was surprised at your take on the liquor that should accompany Thanksgiving. You think this is not really a wine day, whiskey,
you know,
and beer.
Can I just say this?
What
this whole traditional Thanksgiving meal, Thanksgiving turkey, the stuffing, the
fixins,
is so tired.
It is.
It's tired. It's played out. It's over. I would love to see some young people blow up and reinvent Thanksgiving.
How would reinvent it? If you were the reinventor, what would you have?
Well, one of the issues with it is that this whole Thanksgiving dinner comes out of this mentality of scarcity. Right? We're in this new world. Most of the time we're just scrapping for some little bit of something to eat.
The berries.
So once a year, you know, we pull out all the stops. Well, these days, we pull out all the stops
every day.
So at Thanksgiving, what do? We kick out the jams. Well, once we pulled out the stops and kicked out the jams, you know, what do? For Christmas? Where do we go for New Year's?
Yeah.
I mean, if anything, we should have a... It should be like a thanks fasting day. A day.
Can I tell you something? In the words of Spiral Agnew, you're a nittering nabob of negativity.
Maybe you should just drink and forget the food.
You're welcome.
So, Jonathan, it's not going to change anytime soon.
No,
can we agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, wine is not the drink of first choice, according to the great Jonathan Alsop?
Well, it's a tough, tough match. There's no historical a precedent for it. There's no like regional precedent for it. I mean, that being said, you know, how we go about it is a couple of different ways. I mean, we do end up matching wine with turkey, or at least matching wine with the meal. Strategy number one. Hey, so who's got wine glasses? I've got wine for you guys to.
You can use your coffee cup
if you want. That's completely
fine. My coffee cup has still got coffee.
So now, Marjorie,
in it.
Last time I was here, do you remember your reaction to that Nine Lives Riesling? How much you loved,
I loved
that?
It.
Okay,
I loved it.
So now my attitude is, you know, Marjorie's coming over for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
I don't care what we're having. I'm going to give her what she loves. This is not the Nine Lives Riesling. I'm going to give you something a little bit new.
I love
this
Riesling.
This is Riesling. This is Milbrandt Vineyards Riesling. Jim, you want a little
how's it going with coffee? Good?
It's fine.
Thank you.
It's fine.
You talk, we'll drink.
Milbrandt Vineyards.
This is delicious.
This is a winery from Washington State.
Delicious.
So this is an American Riesling. You can say you're doing the American thing.
Yeah.
Why would you pick
sweet.
This particular wine, though? Would you pick it because it's an American thing, or what else? Is
no.
The...
The reason I picked this is because Marjorie loves it.
I love Riesling.
And so I did not
match.
I did not match the Riesling to the food. I did not match the Riesling to the occasion. I matched the Riesling
to Marjorie,
to the guest.
There you go.
No, you're the guest. Actually,
you're my wine guest.
What great manners he has, Jim.
It's unbelievable.
You learn a thing or two.
And Marjorie, let me ask you frankly, how's this working?
It's working great. The Nine Lives.
What else could I say?
You know, it's so funny. I did buy some Nine Lives after I had it with you.
Uh-huh.
It was wonderful. The Nine Lives Riesling. And this is really good, too. Yeah.
So if you didn't know Marjorie and you knew what she liked, and you didn't know what your guest, as you say, liked, but you knew what you were serving,
then
and you were serving that same tired old turkey that we've been serving for centuries, what would you put on the table?
You know what I would do? I would go with... you know, the national festivity theme, I would go with all different sparkling wines. Sparkling wine.
Ooh, that's a great idea.
You know, my feeling is sparkling wine goes with almost anything. Yeah. Sparkling wine, great with pizza, great with all kinds of spicy Asian food. I mean, great with, you know, great with breakfast in bed. I mean, great with everything. So if you wanted to just say, look, it's a party, it's a celebration, this is our national meal, I like Gruet sparkling wine from,
I'm writing it down, from
New Mexico, G-R-U-E-T, the best, cheapest sparkling wine in America.
That sets people
15?
Back. Oh, 15? That's pretty reasonable.
15, 17. You might find it on sale for 13. Gruet from New Mexico. Westport Rivers from Westport,
local,
Mass.
Local.
Spectacular sparkling wine. Probably the most Westport Rivers has been doing great sparkling wine for 20, going on 30 years now. And their sparkling wine probably tastes more like, you know, champagne.
Really?
You know, French champagne than almost any other American sparkling wine.
So what's the price tag on that?
You know, could be 20, 30, 40. I mean, they make a whole range of different sparklers. So you could get in at 25. If it was a big event, you could kick it up to 50, 40, 50. I mean, but again, when we're talking about sparkling wine and we're in the 15, 20, I mean, it is a holiday after all. Now's the time when we end up spending. But, you know, we could also, again, another great American sparkler is Domaine St. Michel, which is made by Chateau St. Michel, yep, another sparkler in Washington State.
Yeah.
So just open up all those things. Try not to put out anybody's eye, you know, with a flying cork.
I hate opening
corks. You know, be careful and just enjoy it from a sparkler.
What about Prosecco?
Another great choice.
Yeah, that's a sparkling wine.
Super sparkling wines from northern Italy. Yep. Prosecco is not as bubbly as champagne, not as bubbly as a lot of sparkling wines. It's
carbonation is everything, by the way. It is. I'm serious about this.
In sparkling wine,
the proper
level
of carbonation is the whole deal to me.
Well, and so Prosecco has not a ton of carbonation, so it's a little bit more like, you know, wine.
Yep.
And so it goes better with food. More like wine will go with food.
Can we discuss non-food food for
a
second?
Sure.
A couple of days ago, we were talking about alternatives to turkey. You should have been here for this. Would have made you happy. And we had a number of vegans.
Was this the tofurkey?
Speaking of this, is this not an outlier? Do you know who two prominent people are who are now vegans as of 2 days ago?
We know Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton. And who joined him as a vegan, according to the newspaper 2 days ago?
Chelsea?
Al Gore is now a vegan.
I was going to say Charles Barkley.
I don't think that's happening.
You know, but
no, the former basketball player.
Assuming
you were a tofurkey kind of person.
You know, how do I turn my headphones? Can I get these turned off?
Well, what if you're? Let's stay away from tofurkey. What if you're a vegan or a vegetarian kind of person? What would you suggest to accompany their meal other than ridiculing them?
Well, you know,
which is what
look,
I'm doing.
Look, no ridicule. The thing with you know, the thing with vegan food, the thing with vegetarian cooking, the protein is less. There's less of it. Tends to be less protein, less oil, and it's protein and oil that really matches. Is really the thing that makes wine a great food match. I brought this killer Rib Shack Red. I decided just to go the other way. Here's another Red if you guys want to taste it.
Rib Shack. I love that name.
And this is from South Africa, and this is a blend of Pinotage and Shiraz.
Are you avoiding the question, by the way?
I am. I'm utterly avoiding it.
That's fine.
The challenge with vegans and vegetarians is, you know, the food is so light, you need to keep the wine light. You need to find strategies to pump up the protein level of the food, or you need to bring down the intensity of the wine. So this is why people make that wrinkly nose face when we start talking about vegan food and vegan wine, because you're sort of like splitting the difference and you're having this sort of compromise.
But can I tell you something, I hate to disagree with someone with your level of expertise, but I'm going to do it boldly, if I may.
Yeah, please.
What's this red thing called?
This is called Rib Shack Red.
Okay, fine. Rib Shack Red. I would suggest, Jonathan Alsop, after maybe the second glass glass, you wouldn't even know that you're eating cardboard. So
Do you think you're disagreeing with me?
I want to be clear. Okay. By the way, I hate when people who have people like you on say everything is great. This is great.
It's tasty.
This
isn't
is really
yes. $10.99.
Is that
$10.99?
Yeah.
Rib Shack Red.
Rib Shack Red.
Where's that made?
60%. It's South Africa. 60% Pinotage. 40% Shiraz.
And by the way, both of these are screw-offs. So we've finally gotten to the point where we don't look down
don't
our nose anymore. It's screw-off tops.
No. We don't care. If anything, we prefer this.
Why? Because of ease?
Because
I have a corkscrew in my pocket, but what if I forgot it? You know, then what do? We just sit around and look at it and talk about what it looks like?
Yeah.
I mean, these are technically superior to cork closures. So,
by the way,
we're there.
Yeah. Are the little sucker things that you the suction cup things? Those are the best things.
Yeah, the things
the
where
wine,
you vacuum out the wine. Yeah,
not really.
Not
oh,
really.
No?
We need to, someone from MIT can really really explain this. But gas and liquid chemical reaction is not really based on their relative atmospheric pressures.
So is there anything that will preserve the red wine for like 3 or 4 days?
You know what?
If
you have some left, put it in a little one of these plastic bottles, like
water bottle
little plastic water bottle, and then you can hear me like squeezing it out.
Love that sound.
Like right up to the top. Close it off. Right on the outside what it is. Put it in the fridge.
Really?
And for me, red wine will keep a week, maybe 2 weeks, like that.
Hey, Jonathan Alsop from the Boston Wine School. Mm. Before, I want to talk about your preference, which we glossed over, which is beer and hard liquor or scotch, even though at least for Thanksgiving. In
something
a second,
local.
Why were you in Shanghai?
First of all, I was in Shanghai teaching wine classes. There's a company called Trento. Their headquarters are here in Massachusetts, but they export wine from northern Italy to China. And so I was in Shanghai teaching wine classes, doing wine dinners.
How different are the tastes in that wine taste?
No different. The people are the same. The questions are the same. The curiosities are the same. What's cool and what's different is how they sell wine. Because there's package stores don't really have wine. Maybe they have some Chinese wine, some rice wine, some toxic liqueurs. You can go to a department store, like a Western-style department store, and buy hyper-expensive wine,
mainstream the Liberty stores
wine.
Or whatever they're called, right?
But what they have is wine clubs, which are kind of like nightclubs, except they don't sell wine by the glass. It's a very social thing. You get invited. You come. You hang a couple of times. You taste some wine. You know, then you get invited to bring a couple of friends. Everybody checks out, make sure your friends can behave themselves and are cool. And after you hang like 4 or 5 times, then maybe you say, hey, I really liked that Rib Shack Red we tasted the other day. How does a guy go about maybe getting a little bit of that? And then the person says, well, if you like, well, first of all, you can have as much of that as you want. It'd be my honor to sell that to you. But if you like that, come in this room because I want you to taste this. So the clubs are free. They're different models, but the one I was talking to, they're free membership. It's a free membership, and it's just about, in the case of this one I'm talking about, this dude Kelvin, and his taste in wine and his love for life. And you can be in Kelvin's wine circle, and he has a license to import and distribute and retail. And that's how, once you get cool with him and once he's cool with your friends and once everybody's able to, like, hang and be good with each other, then maybe some wine changes hands.
That's some great storytelling.
And it is just the most, like compared with buying wine from a dude behind a piece of bulletproof glass, I mean, that is such an awesomer, more awesome way to buy wine. And this is how people
armed,
discover.
It just doesn't have the same
it just kills it. Yeah. Kills it.
Jonathan, we only have 1 minute left.
Okay.
Go back. I know this wine is your bailiwick, but if beer is the first choice, what would you drink?
Well, I would drink a local beer. I would do the whole, cask to glass, farm to table thing. We got a ton of awesome beers within a half hour drive.
Like
have you tried this Jack's Abbey stuff from Framingham?
Yes.
It is unbelievable.
Fantastic. Berkshire Brewing Company is doing it's not an IPA, but it's like an IPA. It's super hoppy in a can. And the can is the hottest new, like marching forward into the past, retro closure for beer. So they have this steel rail ale in a can, you know.
We got something
along those lines.
We got an emailer who's mentioning, Deb is mentioning a Trillium Brewing on Congress Street.
Trillium, yeah.
Which has something called the Waker Robin, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Never heard of it.
Well, anyway.
I drink that.
Jonathan, a toast to you. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to all.
Thanks for being here.
Very much
pleasure.
Coming.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for these two delicious
You're
going to
mention his
wines.
Book, I hope, are you not?
Yes, I absolutely am. Jonathan Alsop is not just the founder of the Boston Wine School. His book that Jim just mentioned is called The Wine Lover's Devotional, 365 Days of Knowledge, Advice, and Lore for the Ardent Aficionado.
Thank you.
Jonathan, thank you very much for being here and have
Great
a great
anytime.
Holiday.
You too.
I hope all you have a wonderful, wonderful, and safe Thanksgiving. Thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
Very smooth, Marjorie, I should say. Happy Thanksgiving. No, it was. It's the wine, I think. Happy Thanksgiving to you, Marjorie. I am Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
Have a great Thanksgiving. See you soon.